Okay, so hello and welcome again here today to our event. Datenspuren and Libertarian Days are going together since several years now. We are organizing this event together. Thanks a lot to Datenspuren to host us here. Libertarian Days is a 1 week of events with anarchist ideas, workshops, presentations, and we are really happy that we can have this weekend together here. And yeah, there's a lot to organize. It's a self-organized event. So if you see there's some help needed, just give a hand. Also, the whole event is based on donations. So there are several places where people can donate. So please do so. And yeah, maybe you already checked around. There's a lot of events happening. We have a big hall down and one behind this, which you can enter from this, from outside, where there are going to be events, and in the other room. But like everything is here, spread in these different places. Okay, so much for the general event. And now we're switching to our guest today. So we have a friend here from Iran. She's living for several years already now in Germany, and I'm really happy that she's here today. We already had several possibilities to exchange different political topics. And yeah, you will introduce yourself and I will give you the word, and I'm happy that you're here. So yeah.
So I can hear myself. yeah, thank you for inviting me here. I'm really happy to be in Dresden and give this presentation. The information I prepared are very general, because when it comes to Iran, to me, it seems that not everyone knows everything, like every thing regarding the recent history, recent uprising of Iran. And what I call recent is for about like 120 years. So that's recent for me. And I actually like to go over the history because it's very important to understand the current situation of Iran. So I'm gonna give you some history lessons in the beginning, and then prepared some information, and after that, maybe in question and answer part, you can ask some questions and I can try to answer them based on the information I have. But just right at the beginning, I have to point out that since years I'm living in Germany, and it's very difficult to, as someone who cannot go back to Iran because I'm a political refugee here, as someone who cannot go back to Iran, who cannot travel there, it's very difficult to know what exactly happening there, despite of looking at conversations, discussions on social media. Yeah, so these are my efforts and some of my friends' efforts to have a clearer idea of what's going on inside and kind of also see what is our role as people in exile to support the people inside. So these are also like questions that we also face. And I would like to begin with today's this is just a year ago at this date. Jina Amini was killed by morality cop police in their custody. So yeah, it's kind of funny coincidence that I supposed to give this talk today. Yeah, so I will begin. So what I would like to start is that the recent uprising, it's the only isolated happening. During past year, I mean like about at least 120 or something years ago, yes, Iranian always try to kind of find ways with this kind of new emerge of not really new emerge, but when I think it was around the point that Iranian got fed up because of the colonial powers, of course. Iran was kind of semi-colonized before in the northern part by Russia and in the southern part by United Kingdom. And there was no autonomy of the people in the country. Basically, all the trades, all the kind of politics and everything was influenced by these two powers. And therefore, since then, Iranian always try to gain their kind of freedom and kind of decide what they're gonna do, like inside by themselves, like, which later led to and at the beginning some had some very interesting and very socialist and some I can't really say anarchist ideas, but mainly social and democratic ideas, which actually they borrowed it from Baku, part of former Soviet Union. Because there was a time that workers in Iran was going there to work, and they actually adopt a lot of ideas from social democrats there, brought them to Iran, and then start organizing themselves, start kind of work on such ideas, and then the constitutional revolution starts happening. So that was more or less the kind of things I know from Iran history. So the uprising and this try to freedom, try to put progressive ideas in society, when it comes especially to women rights, when it comes to, I will say women rights because since years LGBTQ rights are missing in Iran and it's also not acknowledged. So these progressive forces start bringing new ideas into Iran, and then constitutional revolution happened. It can be considered as, in my opinion, the upper middle class revolution. But during that, there was a lot of committees and a lot of autonomous committees formed, which later led into some sort of autonomous states, first in Azerbaijan part of Iran and then in Kurdistan part of Iran. So this wheel of, pushing progressive ideas was always present in the society. But unfortunately, constitutional revolution got suppressed. And later it content in a way changed due to several reasons. One of the reasons was that Iranians or this middle class mainly have very close ties to Kalergi and to kind of religious I can't really put it this way, that religious figures back then, but religious part of society and Kalergis who were not in power. So there are really close ties between upper class and Iranians and these Kalergis back then. Therefore, the constitutional revolution in Iran 120 years ago is heavily influenced after happening by Islamic laws. By Islamic laws, what does it mean? It means that, for example, if a parliament supposed to, or like what we call it, majlis, supposed to pass a law, then this law, even that 102 years ago, it was established that this law is supposed to go to a council, and then the council can say whether they're adoptable to Islamic rules, and then they can pass it as a law. So even this part was included in the law, during the constitutional revolution, which I'm gonna go back to it later. I'll go a little bit short about history of feminist struggles, the way I can put it, in Iran. So the first woman who ever, back then in Iran, women used to wear wheels, but not a, like a like ordinary ones that they wear nowadays. So they wore it this way that the face was totally covered, and then the body was also covered as well. And it was a punishable act, or was not really acceptable in a society if you as a woman just remove your face veil. And actually the first woman who ever done that in Iran, she did it in 1848. So this act of women, I forgot English word, protesting to the mandatory hijab goes way back, at least a century back, well, like more than a century back, of course. So, funnily enough, she was executed, of course, as the punishment. But then later on, women were also very active during constitutional revolution, but they were not really talking about that there should be a monarch with no power, but also discussing about women in education and that women have to have more or less same rights. These were really like small voices, but they existed. And they also got some support within the patriarchal society from their families. So actually women also formed these committees, and then they also influenced heavily or like partially the constitutional revolution as well. They had some sort of kind of a hidden power, but mainly within their families or like confined spaces. But some of them were also trying to exercise this power outside of it, actually like protest outside of it for women not wearing hijab. And I also want to mention that women not wearing hijab is not only about hijab. It mainly goes over everything that is imposed in society, in such society in Iran, because it's just like a facade. It's just like the visual aspect of women's rights in Iran, that hijab is kind of like a descriptive of that one, describing that one. So yeah, women were actually keep protesting, of course, during 100 years so far. So for example, in 1907, women came to the street with no hijab, and then start chanting that, yo, we don't want this mandatory hijab as well. And then in 1906 and until 1926, women tried to form different, hold different demonstration in different cities and protest for more or less same cause and also for their rights. And during Iran's revolution in 1979, women was also existed in the political scene. So they were mainly part of political groups, political parties, which were hidden. And they were also trying to push feminist discourse in them. But unfortunately, by the revolution in 1979, everything got worse, of course. So after the revolution, for some years, there was no speaking of mandatory hijab. So there was none. And after some years, started with governmental offices. So women who were hired in these governmental offices and working for the government were forced to wear hijab. And then there were also some very big demonstrations, which also, like, as someone who used to live in Iran, I didn't know about them until years later when I could have access to this information, or like try to read and know about the history of what happened exactly in Iran. So yeah, there were protests, of course, and they were severely oppressed and suppressed. And then, unfortunately, I think from 1980 something, which actually forget the exact date, women forced to wear hijab everywhere, basically. And I also remember that when I was a child and I was living, visiting my grandparents, I remember because in Iran, they're not, I mean, we have some minorities like Armenians, Ashuris, and etc. So I remember seeing them not wearing hijab on the streets. And later when I was growing up, I saw less and less people who are not wearing hijab, even from these minorities, because it was not imposed for them at the beginning, and then it did. Let me find my notes. So yeah. So what I want to conclude is that women were always protesting for their rights for centuries. And what happened recently is not that of a new story or news. It's just that in the era of the social media, it just got massive attention, because all the propaganda that you hear and you see about Iran in here. I also want to point that women were also participating in former demonstration and former struggles and uprising after the revolutions as well. So there were different protests rooted down in, or like with the notion of economic in Iran after the revolution, and women were also existed there and were there as well. And then the other point is that Iran's regime, although that it claims, before the 97 revolution, there were a lot of democratic and a lot of socialist and a lot of leftist group involved in the revolution, actually making it happen or actually pushing for system change. When revolutionaries start rallying around Khomeini's figure, which is a really like right extremist, like fundamental extremist figure, some of these progressive groups were pushed out of, or like their ideas were adopted or hijacked, or kind of claim that they try actually to include everyone, every forces to rally around Khomeini's figure. So they also use this discourse of, we have to have a social revolution, we have to give the power to people, and et cetera, et cetera. So from outside, or from perspective of someone who doesn't know the regime in Iran, who is very, in a way, naive to think that the regime in Iran is come from, I don't know, the people's body, etc. They can't really grasp this aspect of the regime that's the neoliberal regime, and his and since the beginning of the revolution, with claiming social, I don't know, justice, and etc., still a neoliberal regime, and since then it always follow neoliberal economy. And whenever I say this, some people say that, but in Iran there is no freedom, women are not free. And I think neoliberalism is not about freedom, it's about how economy work in this context. And if you look at Iran, you can see that a lot of public sectors were privatized during years. So for example, after the constitutional revolution, during Mohammad Reza's time, which was I think shortly, some years, not that short, before 97, before the Islamic Revolution, the oil industry got publicized. No, wait. Okay, yeah, public sector. It got control of it. But now This is actually, and we actually have a date in our calendar, in Iran's calendar, only for this event. So it's like a holiday. And now I actually hear that it's not gonna be any holiday anymore because, well, neoliberal regime doesn't want you to see that, okay, well, the oil industry was kind of publicized, I don't know, that one. So yeah, and then, so it's not even tolerated this much. And a lot of actually factories, a lot of, land, like the land that was like a public land was given to private sector. And I use the word given because these people who are actually claimed to be entrepreneurs and etc. are part of the regime's body and have close connection to them and close ties to them. Therefore, it seems that the regime, actually not seem, but try to privatize the public property as much as possible. And therefore, since after the revolution, there are several uprisings in Iran with this motive. But what happened in the last one? I also want to refer that you probably know about the like current uprising in Iran before the very last one. So there was always about, like it had economic motive. And this one is nothing extra, it's just that it started in a different way. And now here I want to go on Iran's policy to different ethnicities and nations within the country's borders. So the way everything's located is that we have I didn't prepare any slide, I was a bit lazy. I could have actually shown you. Anyway, so mainly political and kind of industrial sites are located inside, like in like the heart of Iran, it's just really in the middle. And it was only for like political purposes or like geopolitical purposes that here are safer. They're not close to borders. They cannot get attacked easily. And they were actually like start building those sites and building those factories and building those army like military sites and etc. During Pahlavi's time. And Pahlavi is the former dynasty, former like the last actually reigning dynasty in Iran, just two kings. So everything actually located inside, with like in the center in a way, and where mainly are Persians. So ethnic wise, they're mainly Persian, and all the other ethnicities living across the border, like close to the borders. For example, in northwest of Iran, we have Azeris, which their language is actually Turkish. It's a, like Azeri dialect of Turkey. And then they are we have some areas, mixture of Kurds and Turks. And in the east-west parts, Kurds, probably you know. And in the south, mainly Arabs and Lors. And on the east side, south, Baluch. Mainly Baluchs and Sistanis, and then in the north part, east part, there are Turkmans, and actually forgot the other one. Anyway, doesn't matter. I mean, well, it matters, but not for our conversation now. So yeah, I'm laughing at my jokes. Great. So yeah. And I want to say that these areas are very rich when it comes to natural resources. So in the south, there are oil and gas. And across the borders, there are different mines, like cobalt mines, I actually forget the rest. But they are really rich. And unfortunately, whatever resources that get out of these areas are coming mainly to the center, where political and economic power, or like, the actually is being consumed. So for centuries, not for centuries, but for years, not even before the Islamic Revolution, these areas kept in poverty intentionally. And also a lot of the uprising in these areas were suppressed severely without even getting acknowledged or getting actually known by people who are living who are like in big cities or like which I'm gonna go back to this aspect as well. So what happened during the last uprising was that Jina, which was a Kurdish young woman, which her being a woman is really important because women for years are subjected to Siva or like to very fundamental Islamic ideas, and not only Islamic ideas but also traditional like way of thinking about women. So like this traditional aspect as well. So she was a young woman who came to Tehran for a visit for holiday and then got kidnapped, of course, on the street, like so many women are being kidnapped on the street just because the way they dress or the way, I don't know, someone don't like you to dress. Yeah, and then she got into morality police custody and there she was killed. I also want to point that she was not the first woman who was injured or killed in morality police custody. So that's actually, in a way, not that common because they don't kill everyone, of course, but it's happened. So therefore, it's very important because Jina's figure is this, it's standing in this intersection of being from this nation, Kurds, that Iran's regime was kind of attacking on for ages. And then being in the center of the power in Tehran and then got kidnapped. And so yeah. And also Jina was not the only, as I said, incident of such. In the past, I think months before that, there were some sort of, I think, conduct from morality police that everyone was kind of in a way really angry and really questioning that what the fuck is going on, and then we should do something. So there was this conversations as well, discussions as well. So when she got killed, I remember that everyone was kind of shocked from seeing her picture in the emergency room in hospital. And then some people speculate that she was dead even before rushing out to that room. And then this is actually one of this the behavior of regime that normally they try to hide and conceal their crimes. So there are a lot of, I don't know, it's a tactic that they use and it mostly functions well. Because when society is getting angry, if you feed them with controversial information, one says that, no, she was not killed in the custody. And then the other one said that, yeah, she was free. And then the other one said that, yes, she was killed during in the custody. So you're always kind of not knowing or kind of like questioning that, okay, like, how should I take side? How should I react? So it worked really well. It's kind of like a smart tactic to use to say that to not actually, I don't know, like in a way control some people's mind in the population. So they actually start using this tactic of, yeah, she was killed, she was not killed before, she blah and blah. Anyway, so when people were not really knowing what to do, Jina's family hold a funeral and they start chanting Jina Azadi, of course, and then there were some crowd in front of the hospital, of course, because people were angry, but then kind of these two together kind of led people, and then with all those economical disasters and troubles, it actually helped people to start like protesting, not only in one city or in few cities, but also the protests start scattering all through the country, which was really like big, because before that, in the last uprising, many small cities got involved, but not that much of a big cities. And in this one, Tehran was, for example, got involved again as the capital. And in some other also big cities, there were uprisings as well. So it was widespread in a way. And then the other thing that happened during this uprising was that for the very first time, different nations start showing solidarity with one another. Because mainly the government, like not the government, but the regime tries to follow this policy of showing, actually putting people against one another, showing that, your situation is fucked up just because courts. Or like to courts say that, because of the Baluch or because of blah and blah and blah. So they try really to put people in front of one another. So it was really great to see that different nations and different ethnics showing solidarity to one another, supporting one another, supporting in a way they kind of common lived experience or like lived under this regime kind of brings them together. So. And the other thing that happened during this uprising was that women was very active. So before that, for example, So women got actually heard a lot, let's say it this way. Because a lot of actually girls and a lot of women were kind of felt what happened to Mahsa, Gina. I don't know. It's actually sometimes confusing when you have this hashtag Mahsa Amini, and then sometimes people talk about it, and sometimes people try to kind of put it this way that, Mahsa Jina Amini and blah, and then her actual name or like the name that she was used to be called by is Gina. I also want to open it in front and say that when you're from ethnicity, when you're from different nations, sometimes it's banned for you to choose your child name the way that you want. So there are some laws and sometimes, and actually depends on people. So for example, if you go to somewhere like Standesamt, registration office for your kid and want to name it, it depends. If the person behind the desk says that, it's no problem, then they can just choose a name, and sometimes no, it's not accepted. Anyway, but there are a lot of restrictions also on the courts and also on Azeris and also, I assume, on Baluch to choose accepted names and not go with other names that are existed in their language or in their dialects. And then emphasizing on Gina's Kurdish name, the Kurdish name of Gina is very important, which I'm going to get back to it later. If I forget, remind me. A lot of actually girls were feeling Mahsa, Gina. We're feeling Gina. I also want to say kind of what I experienced. I came here 10 years ago to Germany. And during last years when I was living in Iran, there were this morality police station in different squares, different streets, and it was really stressful to pass them, to pass these points. Just imagine you're walking on the street and someone calls you, "Hey, miss, hey, sweetie, could you please come here? I just want to have a word with you." And if you go to them just so that they can have a word for you, of course they grab you, put you in a van, and then bye-bye, and then they kidnap you. So yeah, I was always under stress as well, and I know that since I left Iran, things get even much severe. And just imagine that you're walking on the streets, just it's your normal day, you're running errands, you're going to pick up your kid, you're going to school, you're living your everyday life, and just get kidnapped without being able to inform anyone right away. And a lot of actually people lose things like there. I think you probably saw come across some videos on the internet that women are crying or women are like fighting back, and then some people are just watching, and then yeah, just really disastrous. Even like I watched a video, actually several videos, that a woman is holding a baby and then has to hold give baby to someone so be able to be kidnapped. Yeah. So yeah, they felt it, they know it, and there's a lot of restriction and a lot of like laws targeting women's freedom. So for example, if you're a woman in Iran and want to attend school, want to attend university, there are some subjects that you cannot study as a woman. And then there are some fields that you cannot get a job as a woman. And when it comes to hiring, so women are less desirable to get hired in especially governmental offices or like in different, mainly governmental offices. I don't have that much information about private sectors and private offices, but I know that it's a kind of like a law something that men, married men, are in priority for getting hired, and then other men, bachelor men, and then women with children come really at last. So in a way to say, women are also put into really fragile economic positions as well, so they counted as this, not, I don't know, like when it comes to economy of, I don't know, like genders and families, women are really like put in a really fragile and unstable situation. So for example, a lot of women cannot get divorced and have to live in their with their partners just because they cannot afford it alone. Yeah, anyway. So yeah. Women actually also took were really angry, so they actually got heard very in a way louder than before. And during this uprising was the first time, for example, I myself noticed that in Balochistan part of Iran, there's this collective, there are women active for women rights, and they're actually fighting with patriarchy there in their communities as well. And also Kurdish women got heard even, I don't know, like more, and then there are also some, I don't know, seeing this solidarity between these ethnic nations are, I don't know, very, in my opinion, is very amazing. But like every uprising, comes this suppression part as well with it. During this uprising, I was actually, I don't know, I normally don't have that much of high hopes when it comes to regime change, because of different reasons, of course. One of them is that regimes nowadays have more tools to control public behavior or like public opinion, so it's one factor. And then the other one is that revolutions are not desirable all around the world. It actually challenges and changes the world order. So I don't have that much hope for any revolution or any systematic change in Iran, but I have hopes on on changes in society, on like how people react with one another, behave towards one another, how they talk about progressive ideas, how they, I don't know, like several progressive discourses enters into different communities. So these are the changes that I see are happening, which is very great. Sorry, I have to drink again. But yeah, with every revolutionary forces on the street comes counter-revolution, of course. And when this uprising started, it got a lot of Iranian in exile by surprise. I think also Iranian inside also got them by surprise as well, because nobody would thought that such a mass will come to the street and then the struggle, the demonstration, the uprising will happen not only in big cities or not only small cities, but also scattered all over the country. So it got everyone in a way by surprise. And for a while I was kind of wondering how this time the regime wants to or like be able or is to suppress the masses. Because it sounds in a way very difficult compared to the other uprisings. But yet, of course, it happened, which I'm gonna get to that. So I will now, I think, start talking about this suppression part, suppression of the uprising. So after the revolution, regime started to kind of cleanse undesired political opinions and ideas from the political sphere, Iran's political sphere. So at the beginning, they start with far left groups who were criticizing the revolution, of course, and who actually thought that it was not the time for a revolution to happen. And then later they start with executing, like mass execution of members of political parties and groups that were part of revolutionary forces and were part of forces that make the revolution to happen, and kind of also rallied around Khomeini's figure as well, more or less. So that actually led to many Iranians flee from the country and come to exile. So there is this, kind of we have Iranian right-wingers, which were supporters of the former regime, really like extremists in a way of violence, in a way of regressionary ideas, in a way of supporting monarchy, in a way of not respecting people's opinion and think that, okay, yeah, well, we deserve to have a dictator anyway. And then on the other hand, there were these lefties that escaped after the revolution. And during time, and by gradually when regime started to cleanse more and kind of the branches, undesired branches, and kind of come to just a united, kind of like semi-united body, a lot of Iranian, actually there were waves of migration or waves that Iranian had to escape the country. And within those waves and within those, I don't know, times, there were also some people who were in a way from the mindset, or I can say that they were much closer to kind of some ideas of the regime. So, for example, these reformists or this reformist body of the regime that everyone thinks that, oh yeah, now they're pushed or like marginalized in political sphere of Iran, they have a lot of affiliates outside. So there are a lot of people that actually, are very close to this body of the regime or like reformists. So this is first. And then during years, regime kind of exported some Iranian activists outside with the purpose of them taking regime sides whenever it was necessary. And it's one of the times that it's necessary. I'm not really sure if any regime has ever done that. My information on that is not enough. Maybe you can, I don't know, tell me, maybe you know something. But regime deliberately export some so-called, or actually some very famous political former prisoners outside. And these figures for me are very shady. like I myself know that they are very shady, especially when during different uprising, the way they behave, the way they talk, the way they take side, the way they argue is very like questionable. So the regime has these people outside Iran, these former political prisoners or like former political activists or activists and etc., which are ideologically very close to the regime and also kind of in a way supported financially by the regime as well outside. There are like some news or some kind of things coming out every now and then from some of them, but not from all of them, of course, anyway. So these are the puppets that the regime has outside. And there are also some, it seems that some of them start rallying around Reza Pahlavi, which is the son of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, last king of Iran. So they start actually promoting this figure as an alternative. As like, what happened if the regimes go, if Mullah regime goes, then we need like a political figure. We have to rally around the figure. We can't really like, rely on people on the street. We need like, like a god, anyway, to lead the people. And because he's very democratic, he never claimed that he wants to be the king. He wants to never actually claim that he actually always say he criticized the regime in Iran and blah and blah. So we should rally around his figure. And then there was this, coalition, alliances or something formed around him and some other unrelated figures. One of them was a football player, or actually soccer player, which is really, really has this really super patriarchic ideas when it comes to women. And then some actresses, again, apparently just because they're women, they can, which is a bit, okay. So yeah, and also this Hamid Ismail Youn, which is a guy who his daughter and wife was killed in one of the flights. The flight was shot down by Iran's regime during one of the conflicts that they had with the US. So there were actually like, there were some attacks on US military base in Iraq, and there were some attack back, and then I think Iran, there are a lot of speculation that why this flight was shooted down, but again regime started with saying that the flight has some technical problem, that's why it collapsed, and then there were some again speculation and some like sayings that it's shooted down by the Sepah or like by the regime, or no, it's this and that. So there was this again sphere of not knowing what happened, sphere of speculation, sphere of what's the truth, what's not. So anyway, this guy and some families of whoever was killed in that fly formed an association to justify the blood of their loved ones. So a lot of people actually start rally around his figure as well and say that, he actually proved that he just care about justice. So we have to pull him in and then rally around his figure as well. And therefore, an alliance was formed, and then it was like in a crucial kind of time, because it was around the time that people in Iran were protesting, were kind of showing solidarity to one another, and there was no discussion of who's gonna, be this political figure that we have to turn into. So therefore, from outside Iran, from the Iranian in exile and from the Iranian in diaspora, these figures were brought together, and there were a lot of lost conversation only around them coming together. So basically what happened was that everyone's opinion, especially outside Iran, kind of distracted from the actual thing that were happening inside and were only focused on them, supposed to say Iranians. So yeah, these are also very common tactics that the regime used. And it shows actually very much, it shows that how deeply some figures are connected to the regime's body in a way, in one way or another. And also shows that how regime cleverly puts its puppets around Reza Pahlavi's figure, because this clown claims that, oh yeah, I'm in contact with Iranians, oh yeah, I don't know, I have some contacts with Sepah, and kind of say some controversial talks and some controversial kind of words that are very like, I don't know, like in a way surprising, not that well, but anyway. So yeah, it just shows that how, like, in a way, extremists connected to one another. And when it comes to grassroots uprising and grassroots kind of movements inside, how they come to play and how they suppress them together with the regime. So yeah. And I think for the last point, I would like to say what happens actually nowadays, today, or like in the last week in Iran. I couldn't follow it that much, to be honest. But I know that, for example, Sanandaj, which one of the cities in Kurdistan part of Iran, there riots, police, riot cops, and some military is based there. And also in Balochistan part of Iran, there are also some, I think, like very present at the moment. And there were some attacks on, I think, several cities and several places, especially cities around border and cities in Kurdistan, Balochistan, and some, I think, in southern parts of Iran as well. So yeah, this is the current situation. And as I said, my information is not that much. I was just reading some news and etc. So if you want, we can open the floor for questions. I can try to answer your questions as much as I can, and my information kind of suffice. And if I remember any, I don't know, like crucial points or like important points, then I'll try to tell you during questions and answer part.
Working? No, it's not.
But like, do you hear me?
I can hear.
Yeah,
yes. Okay.
Ah, okay. Yes. So yeah, thank you for your talk. It was like, thank you. And like, there were protests and rallies throughout the year, if I'm not mistaken. Like, starting.
Could you say it again?
Yeah, there were protests and rallies throughout the year, if I'm not mistaken. Like, it started last autumn, and like they were continuing for some. Students, and like, what can you say the effects of those rallies on the Iranian society, or like on friends of yours, or on relatives of yours, like who are inside the country or outside the country? Like, I mean, so there was no like revolution yet, but like, what is the effects of those protests on people you know, for example?
What is the what? Sorry.
Like the effect, like I don't know if you can like somehow generalize it or.
It's actually very difficult to say because, well, for example, what is not being heard or seen is that different, for example, teacher unions were doing a demonstration or were doing kind of, collective action in different cities. This is actually went out of so many people's radar, and people on pension are also like demonstrating and kind of are in the street. So it's kind of, I don't know, like so many protests and so many like street action and presence and demonstration is happening under different, actually with different motives or with different ideas, but more or less all of them are connected in a way. And I also want to say that in order a revolution to happen, it needs people coming to the streets and then finding kind of a common ground. So this common ground can be economic issues, since more or less all of them have it. This common ground can be women issues, or like, I can't really use the word LGBTQ issues because it's kind of wiped out. There's no like that much conversation about it on society, but there exists now, of course. So it's just a matter of I don't know, like find or like coming together under like joining the struggles as well. And I think in that part, it seems that there are some lackings and some failures, which I understand, because the regime doesn't want this, I don't know, like grassroots movements, this protest come together under one umbrella, which actually was about to happen during Gina's movements. So, yeah. Inside, I don't know. I still have hope that people can find one another. And it seems that partially they did. So for example, I see that my Kurdish friends are very much promoting and very much kind of spreading around statements that come from women activists in Balochistan part, which were way far away from one another. Or like supporting workers in factories, or try to support pensioners, or try to support teachers. So I see them trying to support one another, but still regime is very clever into separating people from one another and kind of showing them and putting them in front of one another and showing them as their enemies. It's just an example. So during the uprising, one of the most claims that regime and like inside and also its affiliates outside try to present or try to show it as danger was if the regime kind of goes away, if we get rid of the regime in Iran, then Iran will become somewhere like Syria or somewhere like, I don't know, another country, then integrity of the country will be in danger. And when the integrity of the country is in danger, then nobody is safe. And who puts the integrity of the country in danger? The uprisers, Kurds, Baluchs, Azeris, the Arabs. So, yeah, so just, so in a way, you see that it's, I don't know, regimes try to keep people apart from one another, and there are some tries to come together. But when the, how might work, I don't know, and unfortunately I don't live there. But I know that people outside Iran, for example, I sometimes question my role as someone who is in exile and who doesn't have that much connection to Iran and what happens there. And try to kind of find a role for myself as well. So I, so far, saw my role as try to shutting up Iranian extremists and actually asking people not to support them. So far, I saw it as my role. But I honestly think anything supposed to happen, it's supposed to happen inside and with the forces that are inside. Because a lot of people try to impose an idea from outside, it's not going to work, you're not there. In my opinion. I don't know if I answered your question or not, but okay.
Okay, I see we have another question.
So I'm curious what the situation with like environmental organizations in Iran is. Is that like...
Could you speak a bit louder? Problem with hearing.
The situation with environmental organizations in Iran, like are they, do they exist? Are they important at all?
Yeah, I think it's a hit in Germany, in Europe. It's very, I don't know, hype. Yes, they are not well The problem is that in Iran you cannot form any association, any organization, unless you have some affiliation to the regime. So with that said, if you are an independent person or if you are an independent group that doing something regarding environment and etc., you're gonna be imprisoned, of course. This is actually what happened to a lot of environmental activists. They got imprisoned. And a lot of people who actually try to inform, actually like regimes kind of destroying of the nature, they got imprisoned. And actually some of them got killed in the prison. So for example, there is this singer and podcaster. His father was an environmentalist, actually forgot his name. King Rom, maybe you can also search him on internet. So his father was an environmentalist. His father got arrested some years ago and then was killed in prison. So yeah, there are activists existed, activists try to. For example, Urumiye is a lake, is a like a big lake, one of the big lakes in Iran. It's located in Azerbaijan part. So for years, the regime built dams on the rivers that are growing to this lake, and now it's drained basically, and it's gonna be turned into the environmental disaster because it's like salt water lake. Or in Baluchistan part, or in south part of Iran, because of oil and because I think getting oil out of ground, extracting oil from where the water is very difficult. So they drain some of the lakes in order to be able to extract oil and gas, and that's actually turned into environmental disasters. There are activists try to impose it, but first of all, they can't organize themselves, and secondly, yeah, they get prison. But yeah, environmental disasters are very close. Especially in marginalized areas. And there are some, I don't know, stupid ideas, because as I said, many industrial sites located inside Iran, in the center, where there's scarcity of water. So they try to redirect some rivers into those parts, and actually that destroyed a lot of agriculture in areas across the border. And then it actually has no like logical reason beside there are safe spaces or like safe areas where if Iran get attacks. So they're actually investing a lot of money and a lot of like water resources to take them to these areas which are mainly like Persians living, and then kind of, yeah. But yeah, natural disasters are just getting more extreme there.
Do we have any more questions?
I think there was one question there. I don't know if you have a still. Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much for your talk. I have a question about the rallying around the figure of Reza Pahlavi. And you said, or like I understood it, it's that it started in the diaspora. And that
sorry,
that again? It started in the Iranian diaspora, like the people in exile, or maybe not. And I wonder if you can estimate how big of an impact this direction has in the movement in Iran. I think you spoke about it, but I didn't really understand it.
So the thing is, inside Iran, there are also some monarchists or people who are pro-monarchists, of course, and there's no denial on that. But the problem is that for years after Islamic Revolution, or also before the Islamic Revolution, there was no opportunities for opposite voices to be heard in a society. Therefore, when it comes to thinking, okay, who's gonna be in charge of the country, the only alternatives one might think of is either someone from the regime, from the clergy, from, I don't know, somewhere, someone who's close to the regime, or the son of former monarch of Iran. And the problem is that other voices are existed, but they're intentionally dismissed, or intentionally ignored, or they're intentionally not given any weight to. And the other problem is that this, I don't know, I would call it him a clown, because he's really a clown, come on. This clown, they're like, I don't know, he's not, well, I don't know, a lot of jokes. So first of all, during past years, he never tried to, he basically was one of the main person or characters who destroyed any coming together of, I don't know, like Iranians who considered themselves as nationalists, not hardcore nationalists, but kind of like democratic nationalists, and etc. So whenever there were some kind of gathering or some sort of intention of coming together, this clown basically destroyed all of those alliances in a way. So I can't actually see him doing anything more. It's just that he got a lot of platform and a lot of promotion by the people who have affiliation with the regime. So he's in a way got put on the pedestal, and people try to justify why he's a good alternative. So it's just that a lot of, I don't know, news has just got a lot of, I don't know, platform to go on, and then a lot of people got a lot of platform to just show him as an alternative. That's the only reason that you hear mostly about him. He has no plans. His words were very controversial. So, for example, when he speaks in Farsi, he says something else, and when he speaks in other language, English or French, he claims different things. So, yeah, they're basically a clown, of course, for people's amusement.
Are there any questions left? Yes.
I came a bit late, so maybe you talked about it and I missed it. Sorry, maybe if it's repetitive. There's a Federation of Anarchism ERA.
Could you speak a bit louder?
Yeah, I tried. There's a Federation of Anarchism ERA, which contains people from Afghanistan and Iran, anarchists. And I wonder what role, or if you know what role they play in the last uprisings inside and outside Iran, if you have an idea.
That's a good question. I honestly have no idea about it. I know that traditionally in Iran it was very kind of common, or was very kind of in a way more familiar to have socialist and to have like social democratic groups and people who believe in social democracy or socialism or just democratic ideas. But to be honest, in the recent history of Iran, I didn't hear that much about anarchist movements. Which I'm also very kind of curious about, because some people, like some Iranian in exile, claim to be anarchists. So I'm very curious about that. I don't know, to be honest, their ties to inside Iran. Maybe they're in contact with some people. Maybe they're in contact with some, I don't know, groups. I don't know. But on the other hand, I also know that Iranian, I don't know, or Afghans Anarchist Federation, I couldn't come in contact with them so far. I'm not actually sure how they're organizing, how they're like finding one another, how what they're doing, whether they have any ties and connections to Afghanistan, Iran. Like, I don't know. I actually heard a lot about one guy, Nizam, I think is his name, it seems he's behind a lot of anarchists' websites and anarchists' kind of group you hear the name for. But to be honest, no, I don't know. And I actually think that traditionally Iranians, or like because of the history, were mainly socialist or social democrat, or like, yeah. I know about that history, and anarchism was mainly missed, or mainly kind of wasn't really there. Although I can't really say that people are not or were not existed, just that I didn't find any trace of them so far, when I read the history, when I try to find out about the like past like groups and movements.
We have another question.
Hi. So thank you for your talk. I wasn't here in the beginning, so maybe you talked about it. But there are a lot of sanctions from Western countries on Iran right now. And in your opinion, well, the public goal is to hurt the regime, but in your opinion, does it help? Or is it maybe more of a thing so that the regime can say, okay, we are sanctioned and look at these bad guys and we don't want democracy or so on. So maybe you can talk about that.
So, if I get your question, maybe you can repeat your question because I think
sure.
I didn't get part of it.
To put it short, are Western sanctions helping the cause of revolution in Iran or not?
Of course not. I actually call sanctions international bullying of people who are living in a geographic, official geographic borders. I call it that. I actually think that for the sake of people who are living there and who want to change the regime, the sanctions are a burden, huge burden. And so far, they never worked, they never helped. It's actually, I think the only purpose of the sanction is just get what, I don't know, forcing regime of a country to comply with demands of other countries which try to colonize, of course, more countries, and then we try to keep them under the power and then get their gains from them. So it's the only purpose of I think, sanctions. And unfortunately, after the revolution in Iran, they only cause more corruption. And they only cause Sepah. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Sepah. It's like a revolutionary guard, which created after the revolution. And till day, there exist. First of all, they were kind of like a semi-military or like army or something whose purpose was to support or like safeguard the revolution. But unfortunately, during years, due to sanctions and due to corruption that comes mainly with sanction, they get involved in economic sectors as well. So for example, they are very much involved in oil and gas industry. They're very much involved in exploiting the mines and also keeping the order in those areas which are rich with natural resources. So they're very active in suppressing people, different nations and different ethnicities in Iran. So no, sanctions only brought that, of course.
Any more questions?
And funnily enough, for the sanctions, it's actually funny because I come across some kind of discussion about kind of cameras in Iran. So for example, after Jinnah's movement, there were some discussions. Actually, there are like a lot of oppression goes. I mean, the oppression on women increased. You probably heard about the attacks in a school, on actually girls' school, that this chemical attacks. Okay, and there also is conversation, it is actually ideas of, by the use of cameras, just recognizing faces on the street of women who doesn't have hijab and then bill them or like find them. So these cameras, Iran doesn't have the technology to make these cameras, and also Iran doesn't have technology to come up with a lot of, I don't know, like heavy industry or like many things that they build or like basically they put together on montage, assemble. So yeah, these cameras, I think there was this report that were bought from Germany. And then the Germany or like the company who sold the camera said that yeah, but we didn't sell the technology to use the cameras bit. But it's also funny because a lot of these private or kind of IT companies, like Iranian IT companies or IT companies that are hold or like owned by Iranian outside Iran are very like closely cooperate with the regime, and without being close to the regime, they couldn't have the money to, I don't know, for example, form a company or like form a startup outside. So they're actually getting the technology in as well. So basically, yeah, it's just like a joke. Sanctions helping people, of course.
Sorry for interrupting you earlier. So do we have another question? It does not seem so. And thanks again for your presentation.
You're welcome.
And thanks everyone for attending. And I hope you have a great rest of the day.